Good morning. I'd like to call the Agriculture and Food Finance and Policy Division to order. Welcome. Again, we had a really blistery cold day, and so I appreciate that we've had people that have traveled here a distance. I know that it is somewhat challenging for people to be able to make the trip, and I know that we had some presenters. We may have some additions or corrections or changes to the number of people or the people who are here to present, but I do appreciate that we have the people in the audience as well as members here, so thank you for being here. Today we're going to hear about farm finance and just challenging times with and quite literally weathering the storm as we talk about the cold weather as well as other aspects of farming and agriculture during some of these more challenging times. So we have a number of people who will present to us. At the end, toward the end, we will have a bill. Representative Brand has a bill that we'll be hearing as well. But we're going to start us out. The minutes, Representative Brand, would you be able to move to approve?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move to approve the minutes.
All right. Are any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you. So we will turn it over. We do want to hear from Perry Osnes, who's here from Compure Financial, and Ag Economy from a lender's point of view. And welcome to the committee. Pleased to have you here. Mr. Osnes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Perry Osnes, Vice President of Legislative Affairs with Compure Financial. Appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to be inside today, as we all do. But anyway, just I wanted to provide a bit of an overview from the credit standpoint. I work for Compure Financial, but I'm also here representing both farm credit institutions that serve Minnesota, which includes Compure and also Ag Country. And so part of my testimony will be on behalf of both of our associations. A little bit of background about the farm credit system to start off. Compure Financial and the Ag Country Farm Credit Services are the two farm credit member-owned cooperatives providing credit and financial services to help support agriculture and rural communities in Minnesota. We're cooperatives. We're part of the farm credit system, the National Farm Credit System, which is an association that serves over 500,000 member borrowers nationwide, providing over $250 billion in loans and related services. And we have a specific charter, chartered by the federal government to exclusively dedicate to supporting agriculture and rural communities, and we are the largest such lender, providing more than a third of the credit to farmers and rural residents around the country. We've maintained financial strength over the years and continue to serve our customers in both good times and bad, and overall have a high-quality loan portfolio. As I mentioned, we're member-owned. We're owned by the customers that we serve. Our members have a say in the association, and our financial performance often results in the payment of patronage dividends to our members. We're governed by a board of directors that are primarily borrower directors, farmer directors, as well as some outside board members as well, to provide specific areas of different expertise and perspectives that are helpful for our organization. And again, the farm credit system is really part of over 60 associations that serve farmers in rural America nationwide. A little bit more about Compure Financial. We were formed back in 2017 as a result of a merger between AgStar Financial Services, First Farm Credit Services, which is out of Illinois, and Badgerland Financial out of Wisconsin. Our vision is to be a trusted financial services provider advancing agriculture in rural America. Our mission is to enrich agriculture in rural America. And we currently operate in 144 counties in Minnesota, Illinois, and Wisconsin with about 43,000 clients and member owners, and around 1,200 employees throughout the three states. And last background slide I'll give you is just this gives you a sense of our territory. And I should point out that the green part of Minnesota that you see there is Compure Financial's territory. And as I mentioned, Ag Country is the other farm credit association that serves agriculture and rural communities in Minnesota, and they're in the gray, the western and northwest section of Minnesota on that map. So just for reference, that's their territory, and ours is in the green area. So a little bit about the current economic environment from a credit perspective for Compeer. You know, I think overall the farm credit system is in good shape financially, but we certainly are seeing stress in the ag portfolio, and we continue to expect to see that in 2019. And it really goes across the board. Those of you know that agriculture is a very cyclical business. One of our executive team members, I think, described the situation pretty well a few months ago. And he said, we're in the fifth year of a three-year downturn. And so while we recognize that agriculture is cyclical, it's beginning to pile up here. And so we're starting to see that financial stress with a number of our farmer borrowers. Certainly the dairy sector is the most impacted. I know this committee heard a hearing or heard from Minnesota Milk last week in terms of the unique challenges of the dairy sector. We see that as well. Obviously, we operate in Wisconsin as well and certainly see the strain there, but we certainly recognize that that's the sector that's probably most impacted. A lot of reasons for the current situation, but a big part of it, of course, is low commodity prices, high supplies. Certainly, the uncertainty with the trade and tariff situation is a big, depression, if you will, on commodity prices at the moment. We want to be optimistic, and, you know, certainly this week, U.S. and China negotiators are in D.C. trying to resolve some of the issues with the tariff situation there. We have a new agreement, a new NAFTA agreement that hopefully we'll get before Congress sometime this year. But we still have tariffs that are placed on many ag products that are bound for export market, and that certainly has depressed prices, and hoping to see some movement on that here over the next few months. As a result of that, break-even prices for commodities were below that at this point. And really, as I mentioned, there's really not a profile, if you will. It affects all different types and sizes of farmers, regardless of age, size. It's kind of all above the board. Certainly, it helps if you have a good crop, and we've been blessed for the most part over the years in Minnesota to have good crops. But in some parts of Minnesota last year, that was not the case, particularly in southern Minnesota. And so you couple low prices with not much of a crop, and that adds additional stress as well. If there's a piece of good news with this, Congress did pass a new farm bill last December and was signed by the president. Most have described that, and I would subscribe to this as well. It wasn't a revolutionary farm bill, but an evolutionary one. But I think there will be some good things in there for a number of our farmers, dairy in particular, smaller dairy farmers. I think we'll see some good relief. And there'll be some new options for farmers growing commodities like corn, soybeans, and wheat. And there'll be some options they can consider that we think will be helpful going into the 29 planting season. The unfortunate part, of course, as you know, is that with the partial government shutdown, that affected agencies like USDA. And so whether it's starting to develop the rules and the guidelines for the new Farm Bill provisions or getting information out to growers, that's been delayed now since they were closed down for almost 4 weeks. We're glad they're back in business, but their funding is only now and good until February 15th, until or unless there's a resolution to the budget situation. So we're hoping they stay open, and I know that they are very committed to helping implement the new Farm Bill and work with our customers as well as our association in getting that information and resources out to farmers. So as I mentioned, the farm credit system, very committed to the long term for our customers. And we're really trying to be proactive. We're more than just lenders. We look at the opportunities to help our customers through good times and bad, and we're certainly in those challenging times right now. But a lot of it just comes down to helping review information with our clients to help them better understand their cost of production and ways they can improve their operations. You know, record keeping, I know we say it a lot, but it becomes so important, particularly when you have these tough economic times, to know where your cost of productions are and to be open to looking at ways to change some things. So we are very dedicated, our team is, to meet with our farmer customers one-on-one and go over their operations, go over their financials. We spend a lot of time benchmarking their operation with other operations like them. We use farm business management numbers. We use other client information. Really look for those opportunities for them to take on new enterprises, manage costs, make some changes. The bottom line is our goal is to position our customers to help them make the best financial decisions for both the short term and long term for the benefit of the farming operations. We recognize there'll be some stress this year, and that comes down to financing. Will they get loans in the spring? We are doing everything we can to help them work through the situation, whether it's principal deferment, reamortizing the loans. I do think, and this gets back to the Farm Bill, there's going to be a lot of interest this spring. There already is already in terms of USDA programs, particularly the guarantee loan program for those customers that are kind of on the fence, so to speak, but we can capitalize on those programs to help them get financing going into 2019. The other thing we spend a lot of time on, both of both Farm Credit Associations, is just doing everything we can to help educate and help improve our customers in terms of risk management, marketing, financial analysis. We also spend a lot of time on helping support young and beginning farmers, because that's the next generation, and we have a lot of resources and training. We have a Groundbreakers program that really focuses on young and beginning farmers within our territory. And also just in terms of strengthening women's role in agriculture, we are very much involved with something called Annie's Project and doing the same sort of thing to help women in agriculture as well. We also, as a cooperative, as you all know, one of the benefits of cooperatives is we have a patronage system that really helps give back to our customers when times are good and bad. But our board of directors last month, looking at the financial stress on our clients, decided to really up our patronage dividends that go back to our customers in 2019. So we estimate total patronage payments this year will be about $150 million, which is a $42 million increase over 2018. So I know from our board of directors they're very committed working on helping our customers in all ways possible, including through our patronage program. Mental health, I know this committee spent some time last week hearing testimony. You're all aware of the stress on many customers and many farmers right now. That's an important priority for our system as well. We've done a lot of training for our employees to spot issues with customers and help them deal with financial stress in their operations. And certainly on behalf of both Ag Country and Compeer, we're very supportive of additional state assistance to help farmers dealing with mental health issues right now. We want to be part of that effort to help support farmers during these difficult times. So, Madam Chair, I will stop for now. Be happy to take any questions. And, again, thank you for today.
Thank you, Mr. Asness. Any questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Asness. And I think I'm writing a check to you at the end of the month here today, but not to you personally, but for a payment. Because I am a customer of Compeer, and working with your staff, you know, as land becomes available, I think there's a certain amount that you will loan to based on capacity, but what I've seen at land auctions is that the price goes much higher because there are very large farmers that I don't think they're getting a loan from you. From Compeer, but they are driving up land values even in this economy where they may be paying $2,000 or $3,000 more than what Compeer would. And so I'm wondering, how do we deal with that? Because that prevents new farmers, whether they're young or old, whether they're trying to get started, they just can't compete with it. I know of several that in an auction they cannot compete with someone driving up land values, which also drives up land rent, yes. Cash rent. So I'm wondering what you're seeing relating to inflation of land values, even in this difficult economy, and how you as Compeer are dealing with that.
Yeah. Mr. Austin.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen. Yeah, that's a good question. You know, despite the economic challenges we've talked about, there are farmers that are still bidding for land. And you know, I think a lot of that is localized in many cases from what I see. Maybe that's not always the case, but you know, getting back to the cost thing, it becomes very difficult to cash flow prices at those land values going up or cash rent. So I don't know that I've got a complete answer for you, but it's certainly watching real carefully. As you know, land values are also part of a farmer's equity, and so keeping them fairly strong is important right now too. But I think in many cases, from what I'm seeing across our territory, is oftentimes those land purchases or those driving up are kind of a localized phenomenon and not an overall phenomenon, so it's kind of hard to really address that on a broad scale.
Representative Hansen?
Just, Madam Chair, I think it's the key issue, because we can We can do a lot of program work, but if somebody's going to drive, if they're going to go until they get it in the market, it's really hard for people to get started mm-hmm. to compete with that because you can't take the risky loan. That they can only go so far on the market.
Yeah.
And my concern is that those who've driven up the price come back to us later on, or they come back to you and want assistance.
It is a challenging economics issue, isn't it? Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My question is, earlier we heard testimony about farmers getting in trouble and the devastating effects that that has on families. And the particular testifier spoke about only being able to receive loans at 65% of the property value, which I think goes to Representative Hansen's statement. So my question to you is, in your loan agreements with your farmers, do you use mandatory arbitration clauses, or do you use mandatory mediation clauses once you know that a farmer is in trouble and needs assistance restructuring those loans?
Mr. Austin.
And Chair, Representative, one of the provisions of the Farm Credit System is there's actually something called the borrower's rights stipulation, if you will. So when we get into those situations, there are some clear processes we follow so that there's no surprises, so that we're transparent. We want to try to identify those problems, though, before they get to the point where they're really in trouble, which, again, gets back to what I said. We spend a lot of time, our team does, working with our clients throughout the year so that we don't get to that point. But there are some specific clauses in our under our federal charter for borrower's rights, so we follow them very closely.
Representative Cleburne.
So my question still remains, in those rights and in the process that you must go through, is there mandatory arbitration or is there opportunity for mediation in those clauses?
Mr. Austin.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure specifically what's in there. I just don't know, quite honestly. But to this point, we haven't had a lot of those bad situations yet. And again, I think we are always going to be looking for, in many cases, these are long-term customers, so we're not looking to help people exit the business if we can at all help them.
Mm-hmm. Please, I ask one more time. So when we are talking about the lower commodity prices and we're talking about dairy being in so much trouble, I understand that we want farmers to be in the business for a long time. But if you could please follow up with me later and let me know if those rights have or those processes have mandatory arbitration or mediation, I would greatly appreciate it.
And I'm sure, Representative, I'm happy to. Yeah, I'll also explain a little bit more about our borrower's rights provisions that we have. They're part of the farm credit.
Yeah, I would greatly appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other questions? All right. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we, on the agenda, we have someone from the Farmer Lender Mediation Program that may be able to answer some of these questions.
Thank you. Yes. Well, thank you for the presentation. You know, I know these are challenging times, and it's challenging times for everyone along that economic spectrum when it comes to farmers and lenders and people having those conversations during the tough times and regarding the challenges. So I appreciate that you're able to come in today and give us kind of the overview, and I think we all are better educated now. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Camille.
And next, we are going to hear from some trends and usage of programs that are designed to support farmers during difficult financial times. So Matt McDevitt from the be coming down, as well as Kent Olson and Brad Schlesher will be coming down. Thank you. So I think we'll be able to have you maybe all seated and be able to provide some information to us. Just as a note on Mr. Austin's presentation, that will be on the website. So if you wanted to be able to review it later, please feel free to do that. Welcome to the committee, and so we're going to just have you introduce yourselves as you make your presentation. So, know who wants to begin. Or
morning, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for having us here today.
Yes.
My name is Matt McDevitt. I'm the Ag Finance Supervisor for the Rural Finance Authority. So today I'm just going to kind of go through some of our programs and their usage and what kind of availability we have as far as funds and that go. So the Rural Finance Authority was established in 1986 out of the last farm crisis, and that started with the restructure loan. And then over the years, a number of programs have been added to help support agriculture in the state of Minnesota. So our most popular programs, that I won't go through every single one, but it's Beginning Farmer Loan Program, which helps farmers start out in farming. We have the Agricultural Improvement Program that allows for improvements to farms. Of course, the Restructure Program to help cash flow. And then we also have the Livestock Expansion, which allows for expansion of the existing type of livestock buildings and things, as well as construction of new. So those are the four programs we mostly use, and those are all funded with appropriations from the legislature. We also have our revolving loan program, which has funds that, as they're paid back, we can re-lend out. The ones we use mostly there are Livestock Equipment Loan Program, used to purchase livestock equipment. We have the Farm Opportunity Loan. So those are for adding values to different types of things that are grown on the farm and things of that nature. And we also do some microloans. The Aggie Bond Program we also administer used to be used quite a bit, but for the most part has been replaced by the Beginning Farmer Loan Program. So generally the way our programs work is we do participation. So we work in concert with local banks as well as, you know, some of our friends at Compere and the like. And just to kind of keep the illustration simple, if a farmer was borrowing $100,000, they would get $55,000 of it from the local bank, and they would get $45,000 of it from the Rural Finance Authority. This way, it allows the bank to, you know, mitigate some of their risk in that they're not taking the whole loan on themselves. At the same time, our financing is typically at a lower interest rate, because we're able to, you know, use the state's bond rating to purchase bonds and get our cost of funds is a lot less. So by blending the rate of the local bank with the Rural Finance Authority, it ends up being a much lower payment for the farmer, making cash flow more positive for them. So as far as loan programs, those were the ones I was going to touch on. The Rural Finance Authority also administers the Beginning Farmer Tax Credit, which has helped with some different things as far as some farm transition and things like that. As far as some usage goes, so currently we have 553 loans on the books, if you will, for around $78 million. Okay, we have encumbered but not yet funded approximately 90 loans for a little over $20 million. So our last appropriation last spring in 18 was for $35 million, and we have about $17 million of it, so you know about half, not yet encumbered and available to loan to farmers. So we would expect to have that encumbered probably somewhere around October, November-ish of 2019. Now, it doesn't oftentimes take a while for loans to actually fund because there's a lot of moving parts. There's your local bank. Oftentimes the FSA is involved. You know, these transactions can be complicated, so they do take a little while to close and actually fund. But as far as usage goes, Beginning Farmers far and away our most popular program from a loan amount, loan number standpoint. So usually we're somewhere around the, you know, 50 to 70%, 75% range of all the loans we issue are Beginning Farmer loans. So we do a lot in supporting getting our young farmers into farming. Our two other more prominent ones are Ag Improvement and Livestock Expansion. While the numbers of these loans don't quite match the Beginning Farmer, their amounts tend to be a little bit higher as they're doing constructions of hog barns and things of that nature that are a little bit more expensive. So dollar amount standpoint, those are starting to get up over what we would lend out on the Beginning Farmer program. But overall, kind of historically speaking, about last maybe 3 years worth, just to kind of give you some averages, beginning farmer loans are about 61% of the loans we issue and about 45% of the dollar amount. Agriculture improvement are around 19% of the loans and 25% of the dollar amount. Livestock expansion, about 11% of the loans and 20% of the dollar. And then our restructure is about 10%, about 10% of loans and 10% of the dollar amount. So that gives you kind of a feel of how we go about doing things.
Thank you, Mr. McDevitt. Any questions right now? Otherwise, we'll turn it over. Yeah, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you. My question is, how successful is this program? I mean, what percentage of the loans end up in default? I think it's pretty successful. If I remember.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we've since 1986, I believe we have written off about $555,000 worth of loans on lending of a quarter of a billion. So I think that comes to like 0.002% or something. So it's pretty good.
Thank you for asking that question. All right. Thank you for that. So we'll turn it over next. So Kent Olson, you're stepping up, looks like.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Kent Olson. I'm the Associate Dean for the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality. For many years, since 85, I was a professor in applied economics on the St. Paul campus teaching farm management. And I grew up on a farm in Iowa, so hopefully you'll let me know that I saw the light and moved up here. But here I'm talking about the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. It's a state-mandated program starting in 85 or 86. It's funded 70% from the federal FSA, and 30% from our regular extension budget through the university. There's no separate state line for the mediation program. And it is mediation, not arbitration. So, it starts in 2017. The legislature raised that. There's a line that says if it's $15,000 or more in debt on that one line item, and it goes into default, then the creditor decides to they're going to take some action. It is mandatory that that creditor send a letter to the debtor saying that, you know, you are in default, and you have in that letter says you have the option of going into mediation, and that's what is the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. That a copy of that letter also goes to the FLM program. Marinelle Preisler, director of that, receives it and starts the process. I assume, as Mr. Alsness was saying, the creditors and debtors are talking to each other well before that, establishing that relationship, understanding what's going on both sides, but it does come to that at times. So that letter starts a process. The debtor has 14 days to send the mediation request form back in. It is voluntary. It's mandatory. The creditor sends the letter, but it's voluntary for the debtor to enter into the program. And that's 14 days. They can start it, the process. There is a packet. There is that letter that says it is they can opt into it. If they do not request mediation. The creditor can continue down the legal process if they, and it is a 14-day requirement. I presume they're aware of that, or that. And if they do send that letter in, they send it to the FLM program, that request for mediation. They are supposed to list all debts of $15,000 or more. The 2017 legislature also gave the mediator the authority to go check the credit agencies to see what debts are out there. the experience, both in terms of the creditors and the mediators, was it not everything was reported all the time, but we asked and we got that capability to seek out the longer list or better list. And all of the creditors listed are invited and can participate in the mediation program. That it's almost not asked. It's we do really strongly ask them to be at the table or on the phone. So there's an initial meeting, a process between the mediator and the debtor just to explaining the process, and then there's an orientation session within 3 weeks, saying, or 30 days, of all the debtors and the creditors talking about what's going on, what's up, what are the next steps. And there is a 90-day requirement to finish that mediation process about what is going to happen, what can be done, how can they work through this situation. I know some that go extend beyond 90 days, but that's becomes a mutual agreement among all the parties. But there is that. At the end of 90 days, there's an agreement, there's a lack of good faith, or there's no agreement. It is mediation. The lack of good faith is the 2017 legislature also strengthened that a bit on both sides of what that is, how to determine it, and what can happen. So both the creditor and the debtor has to be working in good faith with each other, sharing information and so on. If there's no agreement, we don't know what happens after that. We assume, you know, there could be a repossession. Could be the, in case they decide not to go to mediation, it could be the that letter, and if you ever see it, it's a strongly worded in all caps letter. It gets your attention, and it could be that debtor realizes the creditor is serious, I better pay. That happens. Other times it goes down the legal road farther. It is federally funded, so our reporting is on a federal fiscal year. The last one, fiscal year 18, from October 2017 through September 2018, there was over 3,000 notices that we received. About 26% of those asked for mediation, and about 84% of those reached an agreement. If they don't reach an agreement, we assume they work out some resolution, they make the debt current, restructure it, file bankruptcy, abandoning, but it's not mandatory that they tell us what they do if they don't ask mediation or they don't reach an agreement. We just kind of know those are some of the things that happen. And there was about 33,000 contacts with the FLM program within that fiscal year, 18. We have about five FTE, full-time equivalents, that work for FLM, 6 part-time mediators, 2 part-time financial analysts, 2 full-time administrative assistants, a full-time director who's also a mediator, Marianne Preisler, and then additional staff, myself, Grant, financial legal support at the U that aren't part of that day-to-day operation. And most of the notices, just look at where the farms are in Minnesota. That's where most of the notices are, from southeast Minnesota over to southwest up through the western side into the northwest. Not so much in northeast, north central, but there aren't many farms in northeast and north central either. Most of the creditors, banks by far, almost half of the notices come from banks, implement dealers and manufacturers, about 27%. And then Farm Credit, Compere, Ag Country, Ag Bank, about 18%. And the rest from USDA and others, contractor deeds and so on. Most of them, almost half of them, are from crop farmers who are dealing with crops, cattle, poultry, and so on. It's a mix there, too, kind of what we expect as we know. The average debtor in mediation, a 55-year-old sole proprietor, but they range from 20 to 93 in this past fiscal year. Those that owned land for about 28 years, they owned 436 acres on average, an average ag debt of $190,000, median non-farm income of $54,000, and median family living expenses of $48,000. So not all small, not all large farms in mediation. If you look, this is a, I'm a teacher, I have a handout. If you look at this that I think is in your packet, it shows what we knew, what was going on at the end of December. Today's the end of January, so I'll be getting the January numbers. If you look at it, the last gray number, January numbers as of a couple days ago, looks like we will be higher than what it was last year. Last year there was just under 300 notices received during January in 2018. This year in 2019, we're already over 300, and it looks like it'll be up towards 330 or so. So it will be higher. And if you account for that, in 2017, the legislature raised that minimum from 5,000 to 15,000. And an estimate I made back a few months ago was that that took out about 10%, maybe a little more, of notices that we received. So to put it on an equal footing, we're probably under conditions that are in the 350 or a little bit more in terms of the letters we received in January, which is another signal besides looking at net farm income estimates at prices and yields. It's another signal that it is tough financial times out there. So these a couple little graphs, you can see that the last few years we have seen higher numbers compared to the recession back in 2008, 2009, 2010. And those are similar levels from 1980s, those that time then too. But the monthly variation does remain high, so we don't really know what the next few months are. But the last few months, this January, February, March, as the requests for new operating loans come in, I think that has become a trigger for some discussions on default. So we may be seeing an increase there, but we'll have to wait to see what those months show up. So, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Olson. Yes, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that this past or this recent year, there are about 3,000 notices and only about 26% of those ask for mediation. Do you know why the other larger percentage don't ask for mediation?
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't know for sure because we don't ask. It's a confidential process. If they don't respond, we don't quiz them on that. We just assume it's a case that they do indeed pay up. They make the debt current, or they walk away from that asset, that collateral, or there's it's refinanced. We don't have a specific answer for that.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you. Okay. So, Mr. Schlesser, please
good morning.
Introduce yourself and go ahead.
Pleasure to be here this morning. Brad Schlesser is my name, and I have been involved with agricultural education for my professional career. I'm currently at South Central College, North Mankato and Faribault campuses, and I concurrently serve as the Dean of Agriculture there for the academic programs, and I am fortunate to support the Southern Agricultural Center of Excellence, and that's for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, so that ranges across the southern half of the state of Minnesota. Pleased to be here to share with you this morning about the Farm Business Management program education-wise, supported in 8 different institutions within the Minnesota state system, Northland, Alexandria, Central Lakes, Ridgewater, St. Cloud, Minnesota West, Riverland, and South Central College. We have approximately 3,000 farmers that are enrolled in the Farm Business Management Program. We've got over 67 faculty that are currently working to provide education and to provide advice for farmers that are looking to reach success in their farm operations. Farm Business Management started back in the 1950s, and I've got 15 faculty that are working for South Central College. Last year we had 604 students that were enrolled, student farmers that were enrolled in Farm Business Management education. I'll share more about that. Farm Business Management education is supported by 2 centers of excellence. I'm representing the South. Keith Olander is out of Central Lakes College up in Staples, and he supports the northern half of the state of Minnesota. And between the two of us, we provide professional development and support for the faculty in our respective centers. What are the outcomes of farm business management education? Students are enrolled. They're there for education purposes primarily, but we certainly assist with benchmarking, record keeping, guidance. We provide an independent advising capacity. There's really nothing that is exchanged in terms of a product. Farmers can go to their agronomist or their nutritionist or to the veterinarian, and there's always something exchanged there. And when people ask me about farm business management education, I really point out the reality is this is about education. Some students are just enrolling first month. Many beginning farmers are in that mode. We've seen an uptick in the demand for education in farm business operations, and very similar to what Dr. Olson indicated, the age range I've seen as low as 16 years of age and as high as 90 years of age enrolled in farm business management education. Talked with a lot of individuals that have been enrolled for just that first year, but many that are we're talking over 30 or 40 years. I want to identify one of the attributes, and this is a real collaborative approach between the Minnesota State Agricultural Education System and the University of Minnesota. We do collaborate significantly with the Center for Farm Financial Management. 3,000-plus farmers that were enrolled last year, we had just over 2,100 of them that actually did enterprise analysis and whole farm analysis. Thus, we contribute that to the database at the Center for Farm Financial Management in FinBin, which is a financial benchmarking resource. It's the largest data set in the country. Last year, we had pushing over 34,000 queries, and it certainly helps guide questions, standards, rates, and future. Certainly supports our farm economy. Gives individuals that are starting a real sense of where they should be in terms of budgeting and planning purposes. Sometimes a person really would like to know, I've been in education since 1983, and I kind of think about that. Started in Medillia, Minnesota, teaching high school agriculture, and what kind of an impact did you have? You question yourself at times. Now, 40 years later, I run into some of those students that were in that first class, and you can measure it. When we talk about farm business management education, we ask those farmer students, what was the impact of their enrollment in farm business management education? And between $5,000 to $25,000 of economic added value is what they indicate, they meaning about 40% of the producers enrolled in the farm business management education. Some have said no gain, economic gain, but the knowledge is really what they appreciate. There are some that have said, hey, it's in excess of $100,000. To give you a benchmark, it really depends on the 8 institutions where a student farmer would be enrolled. Tuition rates are determined in that unique, autonomous manner in which the Minnesota state system operates, but I would share with you it's somewhere between $1,700 and $1,800 for a year's worth of tuition if a person is full-time enrolled. There is assistance to beginning farmers specifically. We collaborate with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and this past year, about $600,000 was provided for beginning farmer scholarships, those that were first enrollees or in less than 4 years enrollment in farm business management education. There were 638 individuals that enrolled in the beginning farmers program. I believe that's 4 years that we've been in that, supporting that design, and it has increased each year. I would also identify that assistance for beginning farmers is beginning farmer tax credit, and our farm business management educators work with students that are enrolled in the program to assist in that reality. There are some individuals that don't meet beginning farmer criteria and are experiencing the financial stresses that are out there. Historically, just give you a sense. So last year, right now, we've got faculty, 67 of them across the state, that are working with those that are enrolled in the program, doing that enterprise benchmarking and the whole farm analysis. I've personally been in some of the offices with faculty and have also visited some farms, and per their invitation to be there in a confidential conversation, confidential educational situation. I mean, I know what their financial status is by the time I leave, and I can share with you some of them have been positive, some of them have been negative. It has been challenging, and we're I guess, consistent with what Perry Austin has indicated. We're 50 year in a row with very low profitability. In some instances, they're going backwards. We got difficult conditions last year, whether it was planting or a growing season or a harvest season. I've travel around the southern reaches of the state, there's still some crop that's standing out there. I'm sure the wildlife are appreciating that. Farmers do a tremendous service, and there's a lot of variation across the state of Minnesota. I mentioned FinBin. I want to give you a sense of the median net farm income over the last 5 years. If you take a look at the graphic, just does demonstrate downward trend. Balance sheet, pretty constant over the last 5 years in our analysis. Again, this represents financial benchmarking, 3,000 plus farmers. Rates of return, in some instances have been negative. If you're able to break even, that's been a good thing. Question mark, I'll just put that out there. Net worth, debt to asset ratio, you get a sense of where we're at there. Red line is decreasing, net worth is going down, debts are rising. Term debt coverage ratio, again, weakening. Around the state of Minnesota, consistent with what Kent shared, you know, southeastern Minnesota, south central, southwestern, up to the western edge of Minnesota and up into the northwest, that's primarily where we see our farms. Sparsity in the northeast, the data does give you a comparison. 2016 was better for the most part than 2017. I'm anticipating 2018 is going to be a little bit concerning. We'll know by about 1st of April what our status is. We're working hard. The farm business management educators are doing an awful lot of analysis at this point. Median net farm income kind of gives you a sense of where we're at there. We typically break down as we analyze data into the high 20%, the mid-range, and the low 20%. All trends are dipping. Family living expenses, you know, what does it take to, oh, let's just say here on a beautiful January morning, what does it take to pay for your heat bill? You know, some of those kind of things. We're seeing belt tightening, I guess, is a good way to describe that. Those who kept detailed living records are demonstrating that in order to be resilient, they certainly need to budget appropriately and live below their means. What do we see on the horizon? Just to give you a sense, Minnesota, very significant corn and soybean production. Our indications are just in the last 5 years, corn production has been at break-even. At best, beans kind of depends. I think was mentioned already this morning. I would agree fully with the reality of what kind of yields you had and what kind of a marketing plan. We focus on all those factors in farm business management education. I'm a Christian, and I believe in prayer. I think that's important for us also to be resilient. Looking forward, what do we see in 2018? we've got the data which reflects fifth straight year kind of declining financial strength. 2019, we're experiencing some difficulty. I did ask. We hosted a professional development conference in St. Cloud a week and a half ago, and we had 55 of our faculty that were in attendance for Farm Business Management, and about 80% of them indicated they had been working with their students on at least four students that were enrolled, and they were participating in farmer lender mediation. Access to credit we are anticipating is going to be reduced, possibly eliminated. I've heard stories from faculty that have indicated they're going to be exiting. So that's what we're living in, that kind of an environment. Most sectors are struggling to show any kind of a profit. I'm certainly an advocate. I'm biased, I'll admit that, but I believe education is real important, and I'll just identify the reality. I'm born and raised on a farm in Lesura County, and in the 1980s, when I started my ag education, my parents, after 27 years, walked away from the farm, was foreclosed on, went back to the bank. They left with $5,000, and I just know that education certainly is of benefit to all of us. So I can very honestly relate to situation and struggles that are taking place. And I will identify that in some instances it's not a struggle. But with really good management, someone that is a lifelong learner, someone that does not have to borrow money. I sat next to a farmer last week, and they made $90,000 last year. And they were really pleased and proud of that. Couple challenges we see moving forward in terms of planning for business, some tax conformity concerns. That's what faculty are sharing with me. Succession planning. You know, if you're a fifth generation farmer and you've got sons or daughters, their families coming into it, there's some tough conversations going on. I don't believe our media is really making it any easier for farmers, already identified as the lender mediations. I will share with you that I've seen an increase at my office at South Central College, North Mankato campus. There's been an increase in the number of farmers that have come on campus to visit with Ted Matthews. I trust many of you know who that is. He provides rural mental health counseling, and I've been helping coordinate and support his efforts. We've seen and heard of notices that, you know, if people need help, if they're in strife, they go out in the milk check, or they're leaving the cooperative mailings that are going out. So there's stresses that are out there. From a student perspective, I've shared with you, I've been present with closeouts and what faculty are sharing, and also in visits with Ted confidentially, we've got some demanding situations that are taking place. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm open for opportunity to share any answers to questions if I'm able.
Thank you, Mr. Schlesser. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schlesser, I'm just curious about the farmer who made $90,000 for a success story this year. Do you have a sense of some of the story of that farmer, what input costs were, or kind of different decisions that farmer may have been making that allowed that to be a bright spot this year?
Madam Chair, Representative Lippert, I asked some of those specific questions. A really good marketing program involved in hedging, using options, land rent. We talked about that. He said I would not pay more than $200 an acre rent. Just doesn't cash flow. Nicholas is over 40 years farming, and he said after 20 years he was glad when the cows left. I can really understand why he said that this year. But he said that he didn't have to borrow any money in 2018. First time in, I think, 45 years of being involved, having grown up on the farm, and actively owning, operating, managing, making all the decisions. So you take away the interest costs and lower land costs, that's probably the major contribution. Doing a good job in marketing, those are the factors which would enable a person to experience a profitable situation, even in demanding times.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful.
You're welcome.
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm also a farm kid from Iowa, and I'm in Shakopee now, but parents still on the farm, and I just have a general question for the panel. So we are row crops, livestock, traditional, recent traditional type of farm. And as you look at the graphs and the boom and bust cycle that farmers go through and all the mental anguish and problems and just being able to make money, do you feel that we are near or around a tipping point where a normal, I'm going to put normal in quotation marks, family farm of today is unsustainable? And what does the future like look like with that? Are there some fundamental changes that we need to make or could make here as a state to help the family farm become more successful across the board looking in the future? And just where do you see the industry going on that fact?
All right.
Just a simple question.
I don't know who wants to take that first, but I'm going to start with Mr. Schlesser.
I've got a lot of situations. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. A lot of conversations with young people. I taught for 20 years at South Central College on the agribusiness team, those that were interested in farming. And I think it's on a one-to-one basis. I really do. You know, it depends on what the family dynamics are. It depends upon if there's an aunt or an uncle. Probably more likely it's an aunt that owns some land. What are they willing to allow that land to be leveraged, used for? Person's education, their wherewithal, how they look at things, how much of a passion do they have for farming? I guess I see those realities. My wife and I have two daughters. One is a veterinarian, and I see tremendous growth in the swine industry. She just loves pigs, and so that's what she's focusing on. You know, in the 30 years that I've been professionally involved, I've seen just tremendous change. Doing what I do, if a person has a barn and they can rent out pig space, that's cash flow. Doesn't matter what the market is doing. So those kinds of factors really influence things. Our other daughter and her husband are dairy producers. Got a pretty good sense of where they're at right now. But there's a real passion and desire to farm. My son-in-law, dad and mom aren't willing to allow them to start farming. So he's embarking on his own. So I don't think we have a cookie cutter or template. It really depends on a lot of situations, a lot of factors.
And yes,
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it goes back to that boom and bust cycle. The family farm isn't what today's family farm isn't what I grew up on. You know, it's a lot different. But that boom and bust means that. Are there risk management tools that are available, and are they making use of them? And even with that, the wise manager, the good manager, can get caught through no fault of their own, be it a natural disaster, a policy, a trade war. There are just things that, you know, we wish we could figure out how to not make a man-made, woman-made disaster. But that hasn't happened all the time. The natural disasters, you know, is it insurance? Is it hedging, like you mentioned for that one? But even there can be mistakes made in decisions. So it's that long-run view of, well, what's out there? You know, is it hogs right now? Well, maybe it's not hogs in 5-10 years. But is it hemp production? That's exciting right now, but how many remember Jerusalem artichokes? You know, there is no magical solution. If we knew it, we'd all be there. So it's, you know, it's that management issue. It's watching what's going on. Make, just like in any business, aware of that, covering your risks, being adept and agile to make those moves. To say it was good, now it's not good, I need to move somewhere else within farming.
Thank you, Dr. Olson. Yeah. You know, I think Representative Tabke, our next group of panelists might be a good one also to ask a question. But Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, a very brief statement. You know, I live in a very agricultural district, lots of lots of farms. And as we all know, there's about 97-98% of the farms in Minnesota are family-run farms. And these are very difficult times, and so that's a lot of the things we're addressing, which is important. But one of the things that we also find out is that farmers are not only resilient, but they're very innovative. And in very difficult times, they step out. And so you talk about, like, the hemp, for example. Now, there might be a new product or something, but the farmers that I know in the area, and it's kind of keeping their head down because things are tough. In dairy, it's very tough. There's some others where it's pretty tough. But I'm talking to the farmers, and they're actually excited about their opportunities. And I know farmers in the last couple of years, even during these difficult times, most are finding a way to at least make a living, if not actually some are telling me that they're turning profits. I know there's a lot less now than others. And that's what excites me is that the people that we have farming in Minnesota know how to get this done. And I think if there's anything that we need to do as a state, as policymakers, we need to make sure that we equip them and enable them to be able to do the stuff that they know how to do and not get in their way. So that's what I'm excited about doing is I think this is going to be a time that we can look at a bright future for agriculture. I think the people that are in agriculture are looking at that, and certainly the policies that we move forward with here can enable them, not hinder them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. And thank you to the panelists for coming forward and providing us some additional information. We appreciate that. We're going to call down now this next panel, and this is so Representative Miller kind of gave us the segue to be able to say, you know, these times are challenging, but for some maybe not as challenging. But we're going to bring down Chris Mosel, Ann Schwagerl, Kevin Papp, Paku Hang, think, and they will be able to, so it was a, we reached out to a variety of the farm organizations to ask them if they could find a farmer who would be willing to come and talk and share their perspectives, and so we have a variety of panelists here, including seasoned and new farmers, a variety of production sizes and types, and so we welcome you all. I know that people traveled. Again, we appreciate that you came today to be a part of this panel. And, you know, we are giving you a little bit of time, but we certainly welcome you to come back sometime if you're wanting to give us a greater perspective or to meet individually with people. So thank you. So I'm going to just turn it over. But Mr. Papp, I think I'll just start with you, and then we'll – is that okay? And then we'll have everybody – present to give their names and give their perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Kevin Papp. I'm a fourth-generation corn and soybean farmer in Blue Earth County, as well as president of Minnesota Farm Bureau. Minnesota Farm Bureau has members in every Minnesota county. We're in 78 organized county or regional farm bureaus, and appreciate this opportunity to come before. You know, we've got some serious financial and emotional challenges out there, and I really want to kind of talk about four different areas. You can't be a farmer or a rancher, or you can't be from Minnesota this week, quite frankly, and not want to talk about the weather first. Mm-hmm. It's all about the weather, and I think as I drove out of my driveway this morning, it said minus 34. The farm report said minus 52 wind chill. I think the first and most important thing to do is to acknowledge and thank Minnesota's farmers and ranchers this week for the extra work, the extra effort that they've put in to care for their animals to keep them safe and healthy. Talking with folks, it's kind of up every 4 hours checking to make sure things are working and not freezing up and things like that. As we talked about the weather, risk management, the farm bill's already been covered. It was a wet year last year. It was warmer and wetter than normal. We had poor yields. So what that meant is there was less bushels to divide our costs over. But what I would ask that the legislature do is give us those tools to manage the weather, that unpredictability, the best that we can. Allow us to use technology, whether it's biotechnology seed, as you look at drought resistance, things like that, the ability to manage our water, to be able to have that opportunity to irrigate if it's needed in that part of the state, or to drain if it's excess water. Low prices have been mentioned. Certainly the way to increase prices is to increase demand. We know that 96% of the people in the world don't live in the United States. So trade is so important. That's been mentioned. And that's maybe more a national thing, but yet our Department of Ag, our trade office does great things. We've been involved in Farm Bureau and trade missions in the past, and it's important to build those relationships. But I would just remind this committee, as we think about trade, if there's no transportation, there's no trade. And transportation is so important, and that is something that the Minnesota legislature can help with. Another way to help with low prices is to increase demand or to add value. Continue to please give us those tools in Minnesota to add value, whether it be renewable fuels, the ethanol, the biodiesel, the things that not only add value to the commodities we raise, but also add value to those communities in which we live. One of the greatest added values, quite frankly, in Minnesota agriculture is animal agriculture. Having that ability, it's been mentioned, having that son and daughter-in-law, son-in-law to be able to work their way into a business where labor is their greatest asset and have that ability to be involved in livestock. So it asks to help as it deals with permits, with regulations, things like that to let that next generation become involved. Next topic is decreased farm income. It's already been mentioned, fifth year in a row. Mental health has been taken care of. It's important, though, that we don't just talk about it and that we do things. We know Ted Matthews is important and doing great work, but we can't just talk about it. We need to get that money through the system so we can have another Ted Matthews or two. We've got higher expenses. You know, again, lower yields, our expenses went up. But we have less bushels, that makes it a higher cost per acre. Quite frankly, one of the biggest checks that go out of our checkbook on our farm every month is not necessarily a crop input, but it's individual health insurance. And the cost of individual health insurance for not only farmers but small business is very expensive. In our case, for just my wife and I, as you look at out-of-pocket expenses, for the two of us for health insurance, it's over $93 a day out-of-pocket health care, as well as property taxes, another expense that this body can do some things about. Certainly the school bond referendums, as we look at expense there, homestead credits, things like that, are another way we can help with that farm income. The last topic I'd like to talk about just a little bit is please give us that ability to compete. Don't put us on an island in Minnesota where we have different policies, more restrictive policies than the states around us and things like that. Whether that is in regulations, as use of, again, technology, biotechnology, crop protection products, whether it's dicamba or treated seed, meal mix, things like that. Don't put us on an island and give us more restrictive than our neighbors across. But also as that ability to compete, continue to invest in research, in those dollars to look at what are some of the new uses, the new things. I know AFRAC is not going to be talked about today, but that's something Farm Bureau was involved with at the very beginning and completely support and would urge you to continue to not only leverage those dollars, but the dollars that we invest in our commodity checkoffs into research and new uses. So I appreciate the opportunity to appear before this committee. Thank you for listening, you know, really listening about this important topic of the financial and emotional challenges. Really helps to acknowledge those challenges we're going through. I'd ask for your help to help explain those to other members of the legislature and what rural Minnesota is feeling right now, and we'd be happy to answer any questions at the appropriate time.
Thank you, Mr. Papp. How about we go to Ms. Hang?
Sure. We'll do a little bit of musical chair here.
That's okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paku Hang, and I'm the Executive Director of the Hmong American Farmers Association. It's good to see a lot of familiar faces, so thank you for inviting us to be part of this conversation. What I want to do is three things. I want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that our farmers are facing, but first I want to talk a little bit about who our farmers are, and then I then I do want to talk about some things that I think are working. So for those of you who haven't been to the farm, the Hmong American Farm Association is a nonprofit. We work with over 100 Hmong farmers. Our farmers are mostly folks who live in the Twin Cities, but they farm in rural communities, whether it's Vermilion Township or May Township or Hugo. And they are mostly vegetable farmers. So they grow anywhere from 30 to 60 different varieties of produce or flowers or fruits. They grow primarily on 5 to 10 acres of land, and very few of them, I think none of them that I know of, own their own land. So each year they're renting land anywhere from $400 to $500 an acre. Oftentimes that land doesn't have irrigation, and where they farm is different from where they live. Most of them pick their produce that they sell at the farmer's market, and some of them are moving more into some type of aggregation like what we offer. Given those type of farmers, when we first started helping them or working with them about 5 years ago, our farmers were saying they were making about $5,000 in sales per acre. And last year, based on some both anecdotes and some surveys that we were running, they were making $10,000 in sales per acre. So just over a period of 10 years, their sales per acre have doubled because they were able to access a lot of programs that HAFA offered. And those programs included, you know, access to land long term. We operate a farm on Highway 52 South and 200 Street on the way to Rochester. It's a weird farm with all the little red huts on it. If anybody ever goes by, feel free to stop by. We also run a food hub where we aggregate our farmers' produce and we sell it to about 166 different schools, 45 different institutions. We run about a 600 person CSA, and then we also offer assistance with our farmers around farm business management. We work very closely with some farm business instructors at Ridgewater College. They've been amazing partners with us, and they help our farmers create business plans and financial statements. They help our farmers get access to microloans. And then we also run a really robust research and training program. And so that's a little bit about us, and that's a little bit about our farmers. And I think that, what are some of the challenges that our farmers are facing? And it's so interesting what Kevin said, because those same challenges are very similar to the challenges that our farmers are facing. The first one is climate change. Last season, our farmers saw great periods of no rain at all and then a torrential rain, or they saw periods of after torrential rain 3 or 4 days of heat, just crazy high temperatures, and in given those weather patterns and those swings in weather patterns, it's very hard to run a business. If there's a hailstorm, on average our farmers are only farming 10 or 5 acres. If there's a hailstorm, that hailstorm could potentially take out their entire fields. And even though the federal government has been trying to work with specialty crop growers to get really good crop insurance, that process is still really laborious. And so if it's very hard to get crop insurance, you don't have crop insurance, and then a hailstorm comes and it wipes out your field, you're really left with nothing. And so climate change is a real issue for our farmers. And I think ways that the state could really support us is helping us with ways that we could get access to high tunnels or access to irrigation or access to other tools to support farmers. And so I know on the federal level, they have a cost share program for high tunnels through the EQIP program. But again, there is always more demand than their actual resources. And I feel like those are the only tools that are really going to help farmers, small farmers, mitigate against these extreme weathers. And so that's one of the challenges, but that's also a potential solution. Secondly, I think one of the challenges that are facing our farmers are prices. Last year we were working with a buyer, a large supermarket, and they wanted to buy ground cherries from us. And so I think some of the folks who visited our farm who tried some of the ground cherries, this is a native plant, it's so sweet, it grows on the ground, and this buyer would only buy the ground cherries for $2 a pint. Well, when we sell at the farmer's market, we sell a minimum $4 a pint, right? And even then, we're not breaking even because it's so laborious. And people still have this idea that food is cheap, and it's not cheap. It's really off the backs of farmers. And so I think one of the ways that you as a state could really help us is really support schools, because we have been finding that as farmers are trying to find new markets, the schools and learning institutions have been a wonderful advocate and ally of ours. But they're bounded by their budgets. And so anyway, that you guys could help them so that they have more money to buy local food, I think that would be really advantageous for everybody.
So those are two challenges that our farmers are facing, right? But, you know, farmers are the internal optimists. And so I want to share something that HAFA is doing that I think actually bodes really well for not only our farmers, but for the larger communities. The past 3 years now, HAFA has been working with what at that time was called Fairview, but now, I mean, sorry, at that time was Healthies, but now it's Fairview. We've been working with Fairview to have these ZRX programs, right? And the way it works is you identify, you have a, we have a physician, and that physician identifies a family or a patient who is food insecure. And also, that person may be experiencing or predisposed to a diet-related disease, whether it's obesity or diabetes or, you know, heart disease. And that patient, that farmer identifies that patient and puts them into this ZRX program. And then the that patient then gets, maybe starting from June until the end of November, they get a CSA box, right? Basically a box of vegetables. And the physician and his or her support staff, they monitor that person's health. And they specifically look at these indicators. I think it's called the 1AC indicator, but it's an indicator of someone who's pre-diabetic. And then they also look at other type of biometrics, and they have a survey with the person. They check in with the person, and they look at the person's mental health. And we have found, in the very first year, we only started with 5 patients. We found statistically significant changes in their predisposition to diabetes. And then now in this is going to be our 4th year, we saw great social capital that was being created. And last year, Healthies underwent a program where they were looking at the SRI, so the social return on investment, and they found that for every dollar that was invested in this program, $16.12 of additional economic activity was generated. I mean, for me, that's just mind-boggling. So not only is this program or programs like this great in terms of preventative care, not only is it great on the patient, their biometrics, it's creating social capital, but it's great for our local economies. And I think as a state, I would love for us to look at opportunities like this where we can be preventative, but also, you know, build each other up. So those are my comments, and thank you, Madam.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Hang. Okay, Representative Miller has a...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question, and Ms. Hang, I want to tell you that I really appreciate your energy, your enthusiasm, and the engagement for agriculture. I can tell you that you have that amongst all farmers. It's just my middle-aged Scandinavian men don't exactly exude it exactly the way, same way you do.
Thank you, Representative.
But I can tell you certainly inside they have that. And this is what I was talking about earlier, this energy and this passion, and that's certainly what's needed in agriculture. So my question is actually, I want to learn more. So you said we can come out anytime. I need to know either when, Madam Chair, we could go on a field trip, or I'll go by myself. But I certainly want to know, is this something that we want to wait until spring breaks? Because as...
Yes, yes. In fact, some of your colleagues have been to this.
Mr. Pep said it was, okay, the weather is a bit of an issue right now. So is it more of a springtime sort of thing we'd want to come see when the planting is going and stuff like that?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative, yes. In fact, actually, some of your colleagues have been on the farm, and we would love to host you guys all again. It's a wonderful way to think about just agriculture in Minnesota is changing, right? And we have a growing body of vegetable producers, not just in the immigrant community and other places, too, young beginning farmers. Many of them are apting to be vegetable growers. But, yes. Yes, I can work with the chair, and we can do a tour.
Thank you, Ms. Hang. I do believe we are looking at that, so thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Very quickly, yeah, the farm is fantastic. Ma'am, you mentioned you didn't have access to crop insurance. What about hail insurance? Can your farmers take out the individual hail insurance?
No, we haven't, and we aren't as familiar with that, so I'd love to learn more about that. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here today. It is a great tour. I went on the last one. It was fantastic. My question for you is, how many species do you grow on the farm? I remember you telling us that, and I forgot the number, but it's huge.
Right. So, Madam Chair, Representative, over 120 different varieties. And we know that number because we help our farmers fill out the crop map every year, and it's always still the worst because there are so many.
Yeah, it's incredible. And the best kohlrabi around.
Thank you. All right, we're going to turn over now to our other two panelists here. So if you want to, Chris is here on behalf of his dad. He's the replacement. He's the pinch hitter here. So we're going to have Chris go ahead.
Hello, pleasure to be here this morning with you, Madam Chair, Representatives. Thank you for this opportunity to tell my story and talk about some issues that are important out there in this second round of the farm crisis that we're experiencing. I do have a cold, bear with me. I'll try to speak as clearly as I can. As Representative Poppy said, my dad was not able to make the drive in these temperatures, so I am here in his stead. I farm by Holding Ford, Minnesota, which is just north of St. Cloud. I have a 200-acre farm. It was a dairy farm. I acquired it with the intention of it being a dairy farm. I currently have cattle, but not dairy. My dad still milks cows, 60 cows, traditional dairy farm by Gaylord, Minnesota, and go there to help as well. And I am here today as a land stewardship project member. Just for those of you that may not know, I'll just tell you briefly a little bit about the land stewardship project. LSP has over 4,300 household members, 75% of which are rural and most of whom are small to mid-sized family farmers. LSP's three offices are in Lewiston, Montevideo, and Minneapolis. And we have five core programs: soil health, farm beginnings, policy and organizing, community-based food systems, and membership. Our mission is to foster an ethic of stewardship for farmland, to promote sustainable agriculture, and to develop healthy rural communities. For me, part of what that means is we're not just thinking about producing commodities. We're not just looking at prices, but we're also thinking about the other benefits that independent businessmen, small family farmers provide to our state: conservation, the maintenance of our schools, hospitals, and related businesses. Coming from a dairy farm family, we've been especially hard hit in this latest round of low commodity prices. And I think I just want to remind everybody that dairy farms especially drive the local economy. Every time you lose a dairy farm, you're losing kids in your community. You're losing your tax base. You are, as Mr. Pop said, losing an opportunity for young people to apply their labor and build a career without being all that well capitalized, maybe. So especially losing dairy farms, that's sad to me. So a little bit more about my experience. I did leave the farm. I went to college. I was, of course, encouraged not to farm, but I had that burning passion to to return to the land and give it a try. I do farm with my family, but I've also gone out on my own. I was not able to use the beginning farmer programs because I did buy new land. It was affordable land, but it still wouldn't cash flow. And this was in the good times, so pre-crisis, when dairy prices were very high. So without the support of family, I wouldn't be a beginning farmer. And I just want to also remind people that we want to give opportunity wherever we can at the state level to people of all economic backgrounds, and not leave behind those that don't have as ready access to capital. But yeah, I was not able to use those programs. But I'm happy that they're there. They do work for a lot of people, and especially the support that the state provides to bolster what you can get from the FSA. That is important. When I acquired my new farm, I immediately started transitioning to organic. I'd be happy to answer questions about that process. It is a 3-year process. It can be difficult. It can negatively impact profitability during those transition years. I believe in the environmental benefits of organic farming, but I'm also interested in the supply management that niche market offers. It's a limited limited number of farmers involved in organic production, and that provides some price stability. So I do have that advantage, but I also still grow corn and soybeans conventionally on some family land that's 5 miles away from my farm. So I am negatively impacted by these very, very low crop prices. My small acreage, I am profitable on a per acre basis, but it's still not enough to make a living off. I continue to work off farm, and health care remains an issue for me. Some ideas that we can do, some ideas for what the legislators can do now to help are that we can invest in the resources that help keep the people on the farms by fully funding the Farm Advocates Program. As you heard in committee last week, we can help farmers who are facing crisis by letting them know their rights, assist in mediations and negotiations with lenders. I fully support the bill heard by committee this past week and encourage you to further increase funding for farm advocates. We know that they could immediately put to use a budget of at least $328,000 per year. In the grand scheme of things, that's a small number, but if it helps even a few individuals hang on to land that may have been in their families for five, six generations, or something that they have spent the last 5 to 10 years of their life building up, I think it's worth it. Secondly, as the committee will hear later in this meeting, the state should fund Farmers Legal Action Group at a rate of $168,000. FLAG provides legal assistance, practical publications, trainings and workshops for farmers facing financial stress or legal troubles, as well as staff of the Farm Advocates Program. And then big picture, I think we all need to keep in mind that small farmers, independent business people, are the foundation of our rural communities, and they are a part of our identity as a state and as a nation. So investing in Farm Advocates and Farmers Legal Action Group is these are small steps that we can send, that we can take to send a message to farmers that we haven't forgotten about them, that we still care about maintaining our rural communities, and that we are prioritizing them and addressing their needs. And then this is the point where that's, you know, I'm most passionate about, is that we need to think about crisis, farm crisis, in the long run. I, on my own farm, am doing that in a way by opting out of the traditional commodity agriculture system, but that's not for everybody. That's a small minority. But what we can do for those that are willing to transition away from our core crops is we can support new systems to make perennial cropping, cover cropping more profitable. Our state should be focused on developing our local markets, investing in programs like the Farm to School program, expanding access, institutional access, and helping everyone have access to healthy food, healthy local food. And then we should also fully fund the Forever Green Initiative. Now more than ever, we need to be diversifying our operations with profitable alternative cropping systems. The Forever Green Initiative is doing cutting-edge research to develop and market profitable cover crops and perennial crops. Fully funded at $5 million per year, Forever Green would be as effective as possible, profitably building soil health, cleaning water, and creating more options for family farmers who want to stay on the land. I have made use of conservation programs from the state, and anytime that we can internalize our externalities on an individual basis, we're leveling the playing field and making the small small farmers that we're trying to maintain more competitive. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you for putting up with my my cold. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at the appropriate time.
Thank you, Mr. Mosel. Just a committee announcement. This would normally be our time to conclude, but we have another panelist, and we are going to hear that the bill that's going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So we are going to continue and hope to be done between now and 11:30. But we respect the fact that people came to give us some testimony, and I think this is enlightening and educational, and so I'd appreciate So if you're able to stay, we appreciate that, to committee members. And we're going to now hear from Ann Schwagerl. Am I close?
Just look it up. Okay. Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity, members, as well, to have me here. My name is Ann Schwagerl. I farm in western Minnesota in Big Stone County. I'm an organic grain and livestock producer there. I've been farming with my husband for 6 years, which makes us beginning farmers. Very similar story there. We are organic farmers so that we can cash flow our land. We can fill a niche. In that way, we can farm on a smaller base acreage and still make a family living that way. You obviously don't need me to tell you that margins are tight right now in the ag economy. Data from Farm Business Management shows that beginning farmers, such as myself, are in an even more precarious financial position in virtually every metric that they track, whether it be net farm income, farm size, working capital, debt to asset ratios. Beginning farmers are at a competitive disadvantage with more established farmers. Knowing this, my husband and I have been forced to be creative to find ways to survive during this ag downturn. We started farming in 2013 at the height of the commodity prices, and it was a really great time to get into it. So the last 6 years have been really creative, a challenge for us. One of our biggest concerns living in Big Stone County has been access to affordable health care. We have two young children. We have been able to access health care for our family through medical assistance, through the expansion of Medicaid in Minnesota. Thank you to the legislature for doing that. We live right on the border with South Dakota, and they don't have that assistance, and we have many friends and with young children who have been forced to take off-farm jobs solely to access health insurance. So we are able to, my husband and I are both able to work full-time on the farm, which is what our goal has always been, without being forced to take a job just to get health insurance. There aren't many healthcare choices left in our rural county as we grow our farming operation and hopefully become more profitable as this cycle turns around. We hope that the legislature will expand the buy-in to Minnesota Care so that we can access it anytime, and it can level kind of the insurance competitive playing field. I am able to keep close eye on my margins using the skills I've gained through Farm Business Management. I've been a Farm Business Management attendee, course taker for the last 6 years. Run through the MINSQ system, Farm Business Management gives us tools to create cash flows, know our exact break-even rate, and evaluate the profitability of potential new enterprises. We then have a business plan prepared and laid out when we go to our lender for credit on a new purchase or on our annual operating loan, which is held through FSA. For the first 4 years that we were enrolled in Farm Business Management, we qualified for the Beginning Farmers Scholarship Program, which offset our tuition costs. Since then, we've been able to afford it with the help of the Beginning Farmer Tax Credit, operated by RFA. These programs can help make our tuition affordable so we can continue to be educated by our instructor on that. We're fortunate to live in Big Stone County, which was a 2014 and 15 recipient of a border-to-border development grant for high-speed internet. We have access to high-speed broadband, which helps us in a myriad of ways, from grain marketing to the direct marketing of our meat, which primarily comes into the Twin Cities, accessing the latest agronomic data, seamlessly ordering parts and supplies for our farm, and especially over the winter, we research and improve our agronomic knowledge with access to the internet. It feels so basic. We can become better farmers with reliable internet access. So in closing, that was really short and sweet. I didn't want to take too much more of your time. Being a family scale ag producer is not an easy profession, especially right now. It's through the support of state and federal programs that gives us the resources and security not only to survive, but also to grow and thrive. Thank you for your time and attention today. I'm here. If you guys have any more questions, I'll be available after you guys are done as well.
Thank you very much for the presentation, for you and for everybody at the panel. I think this is very helpful, educational, and we will move on to the bill next. But keep in mind, today is also the opportunity for you to walk through the tunnel that we have to get to the vault or the basement of the Capitol to enjoy some ice cream, because Minnesota Milk today is providing ice cream. So take advantage of that. And I know that committee members are reminded as well. Representative Brand, if you want to get ready for your hearing. Thank you to each of you. But so as people may want to interact a little bit more, and we are likely to take some tours and visits to some of these areas. So glad to have this information. So Representative Brand, we have about 10 minutes for your presentation, and I'm going to just this is the one bill, so turn it over to Representative Brandt.
Yeah, we'll move on as quick as you can hear. I have a cold too, so you probably don't want to hear too much from me. I brought some people with me that could also deflect some questions. But I move House File 158 for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Thank you. I know there's an author's amendment as well, so Representative Brandt, would you like to offer that amendment?
Yes, I move the A19 amendment.
The A19-0001 amendment, so that's in people's packets. And we're going to go ahead and move that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So I know that, Representative Brand, given your voice and situation, and I know you have an expert, because I'm aware of Mr. Carlson. So if he wants to go ahead on your behalf, I think... we'll just go ahead and have you do that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Scott Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of the Farmers Legal Action Group, which is also known as FLAG. Given our time constraints, I think I'll give a very brief summary of what FLAG is and what we're currently doing, and I could touch on what we might be able to do with increased funding to respond to Minnesota farmers in financial distress. FLAG is a national nonprofit law center headquartered in St. Paul. It was created in 1986 during the height of the farm crisis that you all know about, when tens of thousands of family farms were losing their farms. And you may recall in the fall of 1985, Willie Nelson held the first Farm Aid concert just outside of Chicago. In the spring of 1986, the first check Willie wrote was to create the Farmers Legal Action Group here in Minnesota. And it was that check and some state funding that created FLAG just a little bit more than 32 years ago. And our mission is to provide legal services to family farmers and their communities to help keep family farmers on the land. Early in its existence, during that farm crisis, FLAG's attorneys represented a class of family farmers and were successful in having a federal judge order an injunction to stop the foreclosure of 80,000 farms. Since then, our services have broadened, and we function as a full-service, nonprofit, public interest law firm. We work directly with both individual farmers and also provide legal support to other nonprofits that support farmers, such as the Minnesota Farmers Union, the Land Stewardship Project. Really, we'll work with any organization as long as what they're asking of us supports our mission, which again is keeping family farmers on the land. And one of the core components of our work is working with low-income and underserved farmers, such as minorities, immigrants, refugee farmers, and any other underserved farmers in Minnesota. One of our core programs now is conducting farmer education and outreach on laws and programs that will help them sustain their farming operations. We draft a lot of farmers' guides that are into various things that are intended to help farmers help themselves with regard to certain issues, such as, the farm income stabilization programs from the Farm Bill, the Farm Service Agency programs, crop insurance and risk management programs, which are crucial tools now, and there are new products that help farmers guarantee a level of revenue, not only certain levels of commodities, and that's especially helpful when prices are low. We do a lot of work on disaster assistance programs, and we're currently working on many other things, such as a farmer's guide to solar and wind energy. A lending law publication is about to come out that I think will be key as we get into the spring. And we also do a lot of – another component is doing policy analysis for the other nonprofits in Minnesota who support farmers. We occasionally do – engage in impact litigation where if one case, one legal remedy would provide benefits to a broad number of Minnesota farms. And an outline is stopping. But one of the most important things we do, and I'll end with this, is operate a hotline. We operate in both a national hotline and one that is just for Minnesotans, where farmers can either call us, email us, contact us through a website contact form, and we provide legal assistance right over the phone if we can. Sometimes it requires longer-term representation. And with that, I'd be happy. Thank we could you. Distribute a one-pager in writing for the committee, or I'd be happy to come back or meet with any individual representatives or take any questions. Thank you for Mr. having Carlson. Us and thank you for considering the legislation.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like, if it's possible, to get copies of your Form 990s up to the most recently filed. I found that sometimes it's very helpful to see a little more detail into exactly what kind of programs you have and who's being compensated. So I would definitely like to see that right up to the last one filed. You know, they're eventually become public in general, but I think the last one is 2016. So we you know, very, very interested in see exactly what's going on there.
I would be, Madam Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to provide.
You can certainly do that to the committee, and then we'll distribute those. So
we
thank
you. We will be glad to do that.
Thank you. We've got maybe about 45 seconds for Mr. Miller, and if you want to.
Good morning. I'm sitting at the cold table here, so as you heard. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bruce Miller with Minnesota Farmers Union. I just want to, 2 points. One is I want to express that Minnesota Farmers Union policy, as voted on by our members, is strongly supports funding and greater support for the Farmers Legal Action Group and the kind of support that they are able to give to farmers in need. Today and last week, we heard from a number of people about the stress that farmers are in. We also today heard that farmers need a strong banker, that farmers have faith, and I've always found that in moving forward and making sure we solve problems, it's good to have faith, a banker, and a lawyer. And so I think it's important for us to recognize that this organization, Farmers Legal Action Group, provides a much-needed service to farmers. Sometimes that's not seen, but I can assure you that we are often able to refer people who contact us to Farmers Legal Action Group, and they are, if they can be helped, Flag will do that. So, Madam Chair, again, Minnesota Farmers Union's policy strongly supports Flag and increased funding for them, and we urge that it move forward, and I'll be looking forward to visiting with all of you about this and a multitude of other issues. So thank you for your time, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
and Representative Brown.
And Mr. Mosel, you have about 30 seconds.
I'll be quick. Farmers Legal Action Group, this amount of money, it's a small amount of money that will have an outsized impact on individuals as the farm crisis likely continues to worsen. Debt loads increase. The need for legal services will also increase. So I fully support this, and I think it will be very helpful to individual farmers.
Madam Chair, just Bruce Miller again. The one quick thing, a lot of farmers from Minnesota Farmers Union will be here next Tuesday, February 5th, if you want to talk to any of the farmers specifically about this. We aren't bringing ice cream, but we'll bring our charm and our energy.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Just a quick one, Madam Chair. Thank you. Has the organization ever taken a stance against animal agriculture, livestock, that type of thing? What's your stance towards livestock and animal agriculture.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative, as a nonprofit public interest law firm, we don't take positions on things. We are occasionally asked about the impact of certain proposals, and you know, we have testified and will testify about what we believe would be the impact, the legal impact of certain things. But FLAG as an organization, you know, we don't have members. We don't really take positions. The positions would be that of our clients, probably.
All right. And Representative Brand, I know that perhaps more people would like to speak on this or be able to be better educated about it. It is a bill that we're going to lay over. So if you would just conclude and renew your motion.
Yeah, this is an important bill, and I'm glad to carry it. And I would just renew my motion that House File 158, as amended, of course, be laid over for the possible inclusion in the finance bill.
Did he repeat that?
All right. House File 158, as amended, is laid over. So we are at the end of our work here today. Just a reminder to everyone about the Minnesota Milk having the ice cream at the vault of the Capitol, which is the new name, I think, for the basement of the Capitol. So we encourage people to go and do that. And next week, we look forward to seeing you, and hopefully the weather is much milder. So with that, meeting adjourned. Thank you.
Right. Thank you.